rock the shade. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist or a fan that loves them, makingascene.org is the place for you. For the music fan, we bring you in-depth interviews and CD reviews from artists who are on the cutting edge of original music. For the independent artist, we bring you articles on music business, recording techniques, gear reviews, and interviews with industry professionals that give you real-world information to help you negotiate the new realities in the music industry and give you the tools you need to move your career to the next level. We bring you new content every day. MakingAScene.org is the number one resource for the independent artists and the fans that love them. Head on over and become part of the indie revolution.
Gonna rock the shade. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make. Love me.
Rusty Ends from his brand new release, and we got Rusty on the line right now. Hey, Rusty, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Richie. How about you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. I'm hanging in there. Now, good. You've been on the show before, but we always start by giving our fans this opportunity to get to know who you are, both as an artist, but also as a person. So, give us the story of Rusty Ends.
Oh, the Rusty Ends story is, I have been into music since I was a little kid. I mean, when I first heard, like, by Noni Harris, Fats Domino, back in the early 50s, they hit me, and I remembered it to this day. I still remember them. I remember 1955, I was like 8 years old. My dad yelled at me, "Rusty, you better come see this." It was Bo Diddley on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I heard that beat, saw that wild man, and I thought, man, that's what I got to do the rest of my life. And I've just been chasing it ever since. I can tell you, I can go on forever, so you tell me when I need to stop.
No, just go ahead.
Okay, when I was 11, I was already just loving the stuff. When I was 11, I started taking guitar lessons. When I was 15, I started playing in bands. When I was a teenager, of course, I was going to school in the daytime, and I wasn't playing in the teen bands. I was playing in the bands in the bars up and down Dixie Highway. Are you familiar with Louisville, Kentucky?
Okay.
If you're familiar with Louisville.
Oh, yeah.
Louisville is in what we call a wet county here, and that means we have bars and beer joints and sell alcohol. And right down in the next county over is Fort Knox. And Fort Knox, on the base, they could sell booze to the guys. But the county is dry, which means they wouldn't get off that base, they had to come to Louisville. And this was during the Vietnam War. And I was playing out there at a place called the Dixie Beach Tavern. And I'd play from 9:30 night to about 1:45 in the morning, come home, get up about 7:15 and go to school the next day. But I was learning a whole lot more out there than I was learning in school. I can tell you that right now. We just played everything, played a lot of blues. But we'd also play some of the pop tunes of the day, country tunes, anything, those soldiers. It was soldiers and bikers. That's a rough crowd to please. We was playing whatever we had to for all of them. And then there was entertainment was us, some topless dancers, a stripper who was way past her prime. And then, especially on the nights when the Satan Youth Soldiers got paid, there was lots of working ladies come in. And I was just soaking all that up. Before that, my biggest influences were when I first heard, of course, Bo Diddley. And then that Jimmy Reed beat, man, that Jimmy Reed beat just talked to me. I thought I'd conquered the world when I could play a Jimmy Reed thing. And then Chuck Berry, those guys just, for the rest of my life, I've been influenced by so much stuff, but they've never left me. I played in those joints till I got a job with a band called the Premiers. And this would be about 1969. And they were one of the biggest bands in Louisville. Again, we had an 18 and over crowd, but we played bars and played clubs. And we were a 7-piece band. Had 2 horns, Hammond organ, guitar, bass, and drums, and a front man. And we were doing the songs at the time, a lot of the Sam and Dave stuff, Wilson Pickett stuff, Motown stuff. And we looked like 7 gangsters when we hit the stage. We was wearing black turtlenecks, black pants, and these double-breasted purple sport coats with a little gold stripe in them. And we were just one of the biggest bands around. So it was right when I got there, I started with the Premiers, and then I graduated college. And two of the college professors, at graduation day, I was given an award as the outstanding history graduate. And two of the history professors come up and said, "Rusty, we want you to know, we we thought you deserved that award, but we gave it to you because we think you should go on and further your education and get a master's degree in it. I didn't want to hurt their feelings. I didn't want to do anything. I never told them I was never going to set foot in school again. I knew what I was going to do the rest of my life. I wanted to run up and down the road, and so that's what I have done. I have taken other jobs to augment my income, like when disco hit. But I've just played music. I've been very fortunate. I got to play. I got to work with the Shirelles, the Drifters, the Marvelettes, Bobby Tostin, Turnin Lewis, the Coasters. I got to back up all those people. And that just that meant a whole lot to me because those people were important to me. With a band called Copper and Brass, which was just the premieres with a name change. We changed personnel. We had a record out. 1970, it was the first recording session I'd ever been on. We went down to Memphis. And we did the Chicago tune, Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is? Now, they had it out first on an album, and they wrote it, but we had it out first as a single. And from that, we got to do some big shows. We opened for, New Beats, opened for the New Beats. We opened for Johnny Nash. He was great. I loved opening for Johnny Nash. Mm. Opened for the Exiles. And I liked that. Then after that, like I say, sometime after that was when disco hit. And everything just sort of dropped out. Had to put on a tuxedo and start playing country clubs and stuff. To just doing anything we could to make a living. And I did that until about 1992. And I just decided, man, I want to play what I want to play. I don't, and not that music, I like all music, but I don't enjoy playing all music. And about 92, I thought, Rusty, I just want to play what makes me happy. And I thought, I'm just going to play blues from now on, and that's what I've done ever since.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about this new release. Release has that moment or that thought or that story that drives it into existence. What was the driving force that created this new release?
I think, if you notice, this is the only project that we've ever done that would put a couple of covers on it. And if you listen to the title, Roadhouses, Joints, and Honky Tonks, that covers like several genres of music. And my driving force behind this, what I was thinking about all the time, picking out everything, is it blues. Every style of American music comes from blues. Now, those people that take offense at that and say that's not true. But before the blues, we had like, there wasn't any country music. It was mountain music, string band music. It came from Ireland and Scotland and England and Germany. There was already Broadway musicals. And there was, with that, that's more, to me, that's like an English music hall kind of music. I don't know exactly what that is. But I don't believe there was a true American music until the blues. And then after it came, you have jazz. Of course, Dixieland first. Then country music, modern country music came, I believe, when Jimmy Rogers, the Mississippi blue yodeler and singing brakeman, when he started combining blues with his stuff. You listen to his music, so much of it was like Blue Yodel #1, T for Texas. He put the blues in there, and that blues is still, sometimes it sounds like they're taking it out of it a little bit today, but blues is what made country music.
Mm-hmm.
Pop music, you listen to the big bands, whether it's Glenn Miller, it's not as obvious, but it's there. Count Basie, he made no pretensions about his was a blues band playing big charts with 17 pieces. rock and roll and rockabilly. That's just even, they put rock and roll is just goosed up blues, and then rockabilly brought a little bit more of country music back into it, but it's still just rocking good. Everything is blues, and that's the idea of a roadhouse is out on the edge of town where people go to have a good time and they dance to whatever is happening. That's going to be blues or country. A juke joint is where you go to hear just the low down dirty blues, and honky tonk is where you go to hear that really you're drinking country music, and it's all blues. And that was my idea behind it.
Okay. Well, you know, I tend to agree with you on that because, you know, I've always been of the opinion that if it wasn't for the blues, we'd all be dancing around to the polka.
Yep.
You know, and I always said that I don't care who you start with. I don't care what artist it is in today's music. If you ask them who their influence is, and then you go to that person and you look at their influence, and you follow that trail, no matter where you start, you will always end up on the same porch in Mississippi. You know
you
what
will.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So,
go ahead.
No. And so I always believe that the blues is the roots of all popular music today.
It exactly is. And I know as long as I've been playing, music has to evolve. If it's going to live, it's got to evolve. And, I'm not a purist. I don't expect blues to stay Jimmy Reed or to stay B.B. King. But what scares me, and it's probably, it doesn't matter whether it scares me or not, but I don't want people to forget where it came from, the artist that started it. When Stevie Ray came along, blues really needed a shot in the arm. It needed to be jump started again. And he did it. And he was a fantastic artist. I don't want to take anything away from him. I don't want to, because he knew what blues was. He loved it. You listen to his playing, it's very emotional. He looked at those guys like Albert King. The younger guys that have come after him, the younger players, and the audiences sometimes today, it worries me that they think it's all about that solo. They think it's about how fast can you play. They're watching the song and they're waiting for a solo to come up. And that solo is only one part of the song. And in blues, more than any other music, there's a thing that goes back and forth, energy that goes back and forth, a feeling between the artist and the audience, and each one, as they get it, shoots back to the other. The performance builds more and more, and there's just a feeling there, a deep feeling, and it's the most wonderful thing in the world when you experience it. When you go to a good blues club, you would hear, it's not like people sitting there politely, like going to some string concert or something. Those people, they're part of it. That artist, when they touch them, the people have a little aside. So say, yeah, man, talk to me. That's it. You know, just little things. And when that goes back to that audience, when that goes back to the artist, it lifts them up even more, and they dig even deeper. It's not somewhere along the way, light shows got to be in so important. And there's nothing wrong with a light show. But doggone, when people leave the show and they say, man, did you see that light show? That's not the thing I want them to be talking about.
Right.
I just don't want that to be the thing. I don't want the thing to be. I love guitar players. Of course, I'm a guitar player. I love great guitar playing. But I don't want them to come back saying that was, when they listen to me, they're not going to say that anyway. But I want them to say, I don't want them to say, man, that guitar playing just blew me away. I want them to say, it touched me. If people could say, especially the young musicians that go and are so ate up with, like, speed. Speed is a tool. It's just any other tool. Knowing a lot of chords is a tool. All these things are great to have, have them in your toolbox. But the whole idea is what you do with them. You listen to B.B. King, his tone, the way he touches that guitar. Otis Rushman, there is nobody. You listen to Otis Rush's tone, it'll just make you melt. And it's not about how fast he played, but there's no, when you left from seeing Otis Rush, you were exhausted from the emotion. And I'd like to be able to convey that. I can't do it like those guys can. But I'd like to make sure that people still understand that. And I don't want the real blues to be lost in whatever's going on right at the moment. And it kind of scares me now.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to be lost. I think, you know, and I agree with you. I don't think the blues should be kept alive. I think it should be allowed to live. You know, right. I have a thing with that whole keeping the blues alive. It's not something we need to keep alive. It's we need to allow the next generation to put their stamp on it. You know, let them discover going back. And it's easier than ever to do that. You know, back in our day, you know, we had to really hunt for those records and those sounds and those artists and really delve into the, you know, the liner notes just to discover what, you know, where these roots were. Today it's just so easy to do, you know, with Google and the way the algorithms work, you can find, you know, where those roots are easier. But we have to allow this next generation to put their stamp on it, you know, to put their authenticity into the music, you know?
And I can see, like, I've heard rap and jazz. I can see rap and blues. Thing I don't want to be, I hope it doesn't get though with programmed accompaniment. I know there's artists who say, man, I like to go in the studio and I do everything myself. I think it's a shame to lose input from fellow musicians, guys, whether they're just session players or the players in your group together. I don't want to see, personally, I don't want to see programmed rhythms. I don't want to see programmed things. I like the spontaneity that comes from it. And something, it can be magic in the studio. Sometimes in the studio, somebody will do something, and it's something you never imagined. And it's just, I hope that doesn't ever go away. I don't want it to see everything be one person and a couple of electronics or computer engineers who are making that music. I don't want to see that human touch ever go away.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about you as a songwriter. When you sit down to begin that process, what is the mechanism that you use to kind of tap into the muse?
A lot of times I'll already have some ideas because if I hear a hook, a line, a good line, I'll copy it down. I might go back to it 6 months later or something. Every once in a while, somebody will come to me with an idea and say, what can you do with it? Michael Frank, the song Angels Sing the Blues, Michael Frank came to me with that line and said, can you do something with this? And Wayne Young and I sat down and we wrote the song Angels Sing the Blues. And I'm really proud of that song. I think it's a good song. I'd like to hear some really deep soul blues artists do it. But I never go into it to force anything. I hope I can go into it. My process is I try and come up with a good idea, and I'll go back and listen to things. Sometimes I'll work off of a guitar lick first or a chord progression. Sometimes I'll go with a line first, some words first. I don't prefer one over the other. And then if I can, I'll try to find something that makes it unique to keep from sounding like the same old boilerplate thing. Other times, we'll come up with a song, and it just demands to be a straight blues song. And there's nothing you can do it like that. So you just got to look for a riff, look for some really good words, look for something to make it unique. But I'm looking for things that I think will make people a lot of times I'm looking to make people lighten them up a little bit. Sometimes just really touch them deep inside, and always hoping that we're catching a music thing. They'll feel it, or they'll make them tap their feet. Those are what I'm looking for. Normally, I find the longer I have to work on a song, probably the less I like that song. Really, the songs that I think are best will come to me within an hour, and it might take me another couple hours to write them out. Or if I'm writing with somebody, like usually the Wayne Young's the guy I usually write with the most, we'll throw ideas back and forth. But when you're co-writing, it's a whole different kind of a thing. But it keeps you from sounding the same. I like it. It keeps you from just rehashing the same ideas over and over and over again. They have a couple of different brains going in there at it. Can really make things fresher, quicker. But I'm looking for something, whether it be serious, funny. I'm looking for a good hook. And I'm looking to make the music seem fresh in some way or another. And if I can't do that, then just say the same thing different and make it interesting. That's probably my songwriting process.
Okay. Now, of course, once you get a song written, the next step is to take it into the studio. And that's kind of the other half, is creating the song's groove and its vibe. When you get in that environment of the studio, what is your process that helps you capture the sound you're looking for?
Usually, if it's my project or our project, Rusty Spoons and Hillbilly Hoodoo is really three guys. It's Gene Wycliffe on drums, Uncle Dave Zernheld on bass, and me. And we'll sit in my basement and work them out before we get there. Then when we get in the studio, we will record them, and we'll listen to them, see if we like what we hear, and then we'll see if we think we need to video overdubs, if we want to bring other instruments in, what's going to fatten that sound out. This last project that we did, we were at Delmark and recording, and Michael Frank and Julian LBO from Delmark, they all three contributed ideas, and we would try them and see if we liked them or not. Some of the ideas I would think, that's not what I want it to sound like at all. And he'd say, and the night after I go back, I say, yeah, that's just what it needed. When we go in, I usually have a pretty good idea of what I think they're going to sound like. Wayne Young and I, when we kept demos, to demo our songs for other people, Wayne and I, we look at music so differently that, and we generally bring in the musicians at the session. None of them have ever heard it before, except Wayne and I. And so we'll sit down, we'll run it through once or twice, and a lot of times the songs will come out sounding completely different than what we thought they'd sound like at the beginning. And we obviously like it better, or we go back and make them play it over the way we heard it in the first place. But we're always open in the studio, whether it's our project or we're doing demos. We're always open to new ideas and listening to what other people have to say about it. Because the idea is to not do the same thing over and over and over, so people know what you're always doing. It worked for Jimmy Reed. It worked for Bo Diddley with that Bo Diddley beat, especially the Jimmy Reed thing, which I love so much. And I'm glad he did it that way. But there was only one Jimmy Reed. You can't go back. And nobody else could get away with that like he could, I don't believe.
Yeah. You know, I actually had the pleasure of meeting Bo Diddley a few times, and he was a character, that's for sure.
Oh, I had met him, but I never got to sit and talk to him. But our drummer, Gene Wycliffe, played with both several times, and he really enjoyed it. And he said, Bo always came in with the idea. The first time, when they started the rehearsal, Gene told him, I haven't listened to all your stuff. And Bo said, just forget about all that. I'm going to lay some stuff down. You just follow me. said, don't worry about that at all.
Yeah, just follow me, and I'll take you where you need to go. Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about the lineup on this. Who's playing on this CD, this release with you?
On this CD, it is Gene Wycliffe on drums, Uncle Dave Zornhill on bass, he contributes background vocals, and he contributes two vocals, me on guitar and vocals. Then we were very, very lucky. Roosevelt Purifoy came in and played on some tunes for us. Never met him before. I knew who he was, and I knew he was familiar with his history. He was just amazing. He listened to the tunes he was going to play on. Listened to them once. Just sort of fiddled with them a little bit, and then what he played was perfect. Then when I come back to Louisville, like I said, Wayne Young. But he played some guitar on it, some tunes for us. Wayne and I go back many, many years. When I was in high school, Wayne Young's only a couple of years older than me, but he was playing with a band here in town called the Carnations. I think when he was 14, they were about the first real rock band in Louisville. And he's got such a history. He was the guy that everybody looked up to, still is. For years and years. And about 30 years ago, I was surprised. He called me and asked me if I would, he was getting ready to do a project on his own, asked me if I would co-write some songs with him. And I did. He put a band together and I played with him for about 2 years. Then he went on to something else. I went on to something else. And then we started co-writing again. And it's just really, we get together once a week and just write songs and see what we come up with. But he was gracious enough to come in and add some guitar. And I really like it. I think it really stands out on if you listen to Midnight Screams, we're trading off, but we're not really trading off. I had laid down everything. Then we brought it back to town. And Wayne just went in the studio here and played everything. And Michael Frank just sort of interweaved the two. I think it comes out just really, really nice. But those are the musicians on it. And Gene and Dave, they are, and we are Hillbilly Hoodoo. Gene has the greatest groove. Nothing fancy. Uncle Dave, he lays down that bass. It's always around the bottom. And I'm just free to do whatever I want to on it. I'll usually play the rhythm part with them. Sometimes I won't. Sometimes we'll just do it three pieces straight. And then I can go back and do my solos and stuff. And just, I can do anything I want to, and it's there. And it just feels so good.
Okay. Now, let's talk about getting it out there. You're working with Betsy Brown from Blind Raccoon. Tell me about that relationship.
She first did the CD that Michael Frank, he had taken a thing we had out on Rolling and Tumbling called the Rusty Inns Blues Band, and he re-released it, and she did the promo on that, and I don't know that anybody works harder than her. I mean, every day she's sending me, sometimes it starts early in the morning and get late at night. She's sending me things. This station's playing you now. This station's playing you now. I won't tell you all the things she does because they're her secrets. But she'll say, do this and that for the radio stations. The DJs, keep in contact with them. She's got her pulse on everything that's going on. She's just an amazing, amazing person. I don't know if she, like I say, I think she must run 24 hours a day. She's great. I had never met her until this January. down at Memphis for the Blues Challenge. Uncle Dave and I went down just to see it and see what was going on. And she had a little party get together for a bunch of people that she knew, some of the label owners and some of the artists that she promoted, and we were invited to it. And we had a little sit down with her, Michael Frank and Dave and I, separately before the thing started. And she's so knowledgeable, just so knowledgeable. And she knows, I don't believe there could be a better person to be connecting with than her.
Nice. Okay. Now, I get into a lot of discussions, you know, about some hot topic items in the music industry. Mm-hmm. One of them, of course, is artificial intelligence and its influence on the industry. Based on what you know of artificial intelligence and what's out there, what do you think its influence will be in the future?
I'm sure there's places where it could do things that would be really good, but its potential mostly scares me, because if you watch a lot of a lot of people now are so ate up with technology that they almost don't care about the human touch. And I think music, art, whatever it is, it's got to always have that creative touch there. I mean, people are already so impressed that you can feed a bunch of information to it, and it can write songs like the Beatles wrote, and it'll sound like them. That's fine, but so what? Is that creativity? I personally don't think it is. I think possibly you can put your songs through it and let it add something if you want to. But again, I believe art comes from deep inside of you. And AI doesn't have no deep inside of you. It does. What it can do scares me more than what I think it can contribute. I'm sure later on. I don't really care for a lot of programmed things in the studio. When a artist comes out, synthesizers, when you would go to demonstrations like for Korg or somebody, and they'd have this room and have all these keyboards, and a guy would play a line, and then he'd add a line on something, he'd go to some other keyboard and add another line. He might do 12 of them, and then he'd play it back. He had a whole orchestra playing with strings and everything. It makes it easier for a four-piece band to go out and play that stuff. I like the idea of a four-piece band going out, and they don't have all that, so they work around it. I get more fascinated by that and seeing what they can do than if they can play everything note for note with a bunch of strings that they don't really have. And that's, I'm just scared of it.
Okay. Well, you know, I one of the things, you know, because I look into AI and, you know, on the creative end, I could see it evolving into a tool where people can use to, just like they use a rhyming dictionary or a thesaurus or any of those other tools. And then the real power behind AI is the fact that it can analyze a huge amount of data and give us actionable items based on a specific goal. And what that means to me is that it can do the boring stuff. You know, you need a bio, you need a marketing paragraph for a release. Mm-hmm. You need to market your music. You know, how do you attract your fan base? What kind of content do you need to create to get you know the music out there? That to me is the real power of AI, is giving you that kind of actionable items. you know, how to do these things and taking it off our plates. I mean, you've got, you know, like BeatChain and Hootsuite that can schedule all of those postings. So we're not tied to social media, you know, like we are now. We need to kind of step back and allow AI to handle those things and make it easier for us to just do the music, you know?
Now, you've really opened my eyes to something, because I hadn't even thought of when you talked to me about AI. I was thinking from a creative standpoint and what's it going to do to music.
Right.
And I hadn't thought about the business part at all. That I really, really like. And I can see that. I got one time what they call C+ certified, which allowed me to, which said I was licensed to work on computers and do a lot of things with them. And as soon as I got it, I thought, I don't like this. I don't want to do it. But I'm not very high tech. I've not done anything to learn about anything of it since. I really don't like being tied to my cell phone, but anymore the way it is today, you've got to be tied to it because people don't want to. They're gonna text you before they'll leave you a message on your phone and on your answering machine even. So you've got to have it. But I've always felt sort of like it's a tether to me. But I can see where that could really be freeing up. And I had not thought about that at all. I thought about it strictly from the creative point of view. And I thought about it from the. It used to be, remember how every holiday it used to have a trio in their lounge,
right?
And it'd be usually like a guy on a organ, a drummer, he'd be the keyboard player, he'd either have a bass, or he'd be kicking bass pedals, and he might have a singer or a guitarist. And when the technology started coming around, all of a sudden it went to, there was a keyboard player, and he had a beat machine, and then he might have some recorded tracks to play along with. And that's what I think, when I think about technology, that's the way I think about it. And I think about it, it's knocking two guys out of work. It's there's two guys who could be creative on their instruments, but now they got to be creative on their basement instead of in that lounge making a little bit of money. And I had not thought about it like that at all.
Yeah, that to me is where I see it going. I see that's going to be the real power. Because let's face it, I mean, artificial intelligence is not a tool for creativity. It's a tool for analyzing data. And that we need to, more than anything, is tools to help us get over the noise that's out there. I mean, if you really look at it, you know, Spotify has over 900 years of music. I mean, we don't have enough lifetimes to listen to everything that's on, you know, that's out there. So we need to find our tribe. We need to find our niche fan base and get that music to them. And AI is going to be a valuable tool in getting through the noise and getting to those fans. So I think that that's going to be where its power is going to be in the future.
I hope so. That makes sense to me, and I appreciate that and like it. But there is a certain segment of society now that is just fascinated by technology. I know you go see bands play, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
And how many times do you go see, and there's a band up there, and they're just cooking? There's all these people out there on their cell phones, and I don't know if they're even hearing it, but they're recording it and sending that to their friends, or they're taking selfies to show everybody where they're at. And I'm thinking, what? You're missing so much. You're missing this experience. And it's because you're so up with technology and you're missing this experience. And I'd love to be able to bring them back to come in, take your selfie, record. I don't care if you record a little segment and send it out so people know what's going on. But don't miss out on the experience because you're so interested in sharing it with others.
Right. Oh, I agree. I think, You know, but, you know, that's, we're old guys. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, I'm, you know, I was born in 54. You know, I'm 71 this year. You know, so for me, you know, I don't get the whole, you know, tied to your cell phone thing. I mean, to me, it's like a soul stealer, a time, you know, waster. But, you know, this generation, that's their world. You know what I mean? It's,
right.
It's, you know, it's their, how they communicate and how they relate to the world. You know, we may not understand it or want to participate in it, but we have to understand that that's how they do it, you know? And we need to utilize the technology that we have that's at our disposal to infiltrate their world. I mean, that's what, like I said, AI can do for us, is give us the ability to get into their head through their phone and introduce them to what we're doing as musicians and artists, you know?
Well, like I said, you've opened up a whole school of thought to me. I just never had to just now.
No, good. Good. Now, what are some of the things you're doing now for getting the word out and utilizing, you know, social media? Is there any, you're doing any music videos or anything like that?
Well, we haven't. We're getting ready to do a couple of CD release parties, one here and one in Chicago, I believe. And hopefully we'll get somebody to video those and start getting it out. And trying to turn people on to where they can buy it. I'm on social media all the time, and then I follow Betsy. And she's working mostly, of course, with people like you. But mostly I try and get to them through our jobs. And I'm just so old that I've got to just try and learn it as I go along or depend on other people. And that's hard. That's the only way I know how to do it.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough.
I depend a whole lot on Facebook.
Okay. Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with me. We're going to give everyone out there a Indie Blues double shot from your new release. You guys are going to love this. You know what? Just turn it up loud. Screw the neighbors. We're going to have some fun tonight.
All right.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you very much, Richard.
Cause now it's just dead. left all alone. Lord, they need a helping hand. Full of soldiers coming home to a place no longer understands. The angels sing the blues. Let us pray.
Whether you're an independent artist or a fan that loves them, makingascene.org is the place for you. For the music fan, we bring you in-depth interviews and CD reviews from artists who are on the cutting edge of original music. For the independent artist, we bring you articles on music business, recording techniques, gear reviews, and interviews with industry professionals that give you real-world information to help you negotiate the new realities in the music industry and give you the tools you need to move your career to the next level. We bring you new content every day. MakingAScene.org is the number one resource for the independent artists and the fans that love them. Head on over and become part of the indie revolution.